Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to 68 Hours in Hell, Dead Man's Wire, the companion podcast.
I'm an emergency.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, sir, you'll have to speak up. Is this the police?
Yes, it is.
Sir, this is a dire emergency. A real serious thing. I've just taken a prisoner. It's not a crank call. I've got a shot, 12-gauge shotgun wrapped around a man's neck. I've got a dead man lying on a trigger. And if anybody yanks on me, yanks that gun, makes a fast move, we'll die right here.
That is a clip from a 911 call made on the 8th of February 1977. In the call, you hear 44-year-old Tony Karitsis explaining to a 911 operator that he has taken someone hostage and has a rifle pointed at the back of the man's head. He goes on to explain a mechanism he's attached to his rifle, which will cause the rifle to go off if anyone tries to interfere with his plan. The operator likely thought the man was making the whole thing up, at least at first. But it would soon become clear that Karitsis was deadly serious. This call would spark a 68-hour ordeal for the victim, Richard Hall, which would present to the world some of the most bizarre scenes ever broadcast on live television. Now, almost 50 years later, the events of those 68 hours and the wild story that surround them have been brought to the big screen. Dead Man's Wire is in cinemas nationwide from the 23rd of January. I, along with 60 True Crime South Africa fans, were recently treated to an exclusive pre-screening of the movie on the 22nd of January. And let me tell you, it is absolutely gripping. Sometimes when I research cases this deeply, and then a movie is made about them, I'm a little bit hesitant. Will they get the important themes right? Will the victims be honoured correctly? I can confirm that both of those and many more objectives were achieved in Dead Man's Wire, and you should most certainly be watching it. The story that the movie is based on is so complex and fascinating that Empire Entertainment decided it needed to be a companion podcast. Now, if you're not a fan of spoilers and you haven't watched the movie yet, you might want to do that first and come back to this. Either way, you'll get value from both. In this companion podcast, I'm going to be detailing the very real story behind the movie Dead Man's Wire. And the story truly begins in 1932, when Anthony George Karitsis was born in Greece. Anthony, or Tony as he would become known, immigrated to the United States with his family when he was still very young. The Karitsis were quite a large family, with four boys, including Tony, and one girl. As many immigrant families were during that time, the family were quite poor, and Tony's father puts the children to work in his ice cream vending business almost as soon as they could walk and talk. Tony was very close with his mother, but would later say that his father was incredibly strict and physically and emotionally abusive toward all the children. He recounted one instance when he was about 6 years old, when his father had instructed the children to collect the discarded paper cups that their ice cream clients had thrown away after finishing their sweet treats, so that he could wash and reuse them to save money. Tony was scurrying around trying to pick up the cups as quickly as he could, but hadn't managed to get all of them when a car drove past and squashed several cups. His father exploded with rage and allegedly beat Tony so badly in full view of passers-by that the child struggled to walk home. Although the Karitsis family would eventually live a relatively middle-class life, a lot of what had been passed down by their father, both positive and negative, stuck in many of the children, and as they grew up, their sibling relationships were fraught with conflict, especially after their parents died and there was a small inheritance to divide. Forensic assessments by psychiatrists would later show that Tony's life was quite a roller coaster as an adult. He worked various jobs and played the role of a good, upstanding citizen for long periods. But then he would spiral into an abyss, where, as one psychiatrist put it, he was just a wild man. Now, if you have any knowledge of mental health conditions, and already knowing that Tony is going to get himself into some pretty deep criminal trouble in the future, you may be thinking that this sounds like it could speak to a few serious mental health conditions. And that's true. But a much deeper conversation would be had about that a bit later on. Tony also found it difficult to maintain relationships with women, although he did surprisingly ingratiate himself into the police community and became quite good friends with a few local police officers. Unfortunately, when Tony would go off the rails at times, these same police officers would be the ones who would have to arrest him. And by the time the event happened around which this movie is based, Tony was already pretty well known for his bad behaviour. One police officer mentioned that he'd arrested Tony for assault and battery, for a fight he'd had with one of his brothers, in which he discharged a firearm. He was found guilty of that offence and given a probationary sentence, which in South Africa is like a suspended sentence, essentially. If you listen to True Crime South Africa, you'll start seeing a pattern we've seen before in other cases, where an individual commits lots of seemingly less serious crimes and keeps getting away with them, or doesn't really receive a serious sentence. And each time they find themselves in front of a judge, it just doesn't seem like a court takes their previous offences into account. Tony, though, was also quite calculated about what he did and how he did it, at least in my opinion, to possibly try and get away with what he could without actually facing justice. In 1967, a decade before the events that play out in the movie, Tony was living in his family's trailer park along with several of his siblings. The park had been passed down to the siblings when their father had died, and some of them lived there while they rented out the other spaces to make money. But the siblings were not getting along, and in that year, the other members of Karitsis's family got together and told Tony to leave because he was creating chaos, according to them. Tony left, but he was furious, and within a few days, he'd come up with a plan for revenge. Tony took his sister, Essie, hostage, holding a loaded rifle to her head for 2.5 days. He demanded that she sign an agreement to give him a portion of the value of the trailer park, which amounted to $55,000, and he wanted written assurance that the family would not call the police or try to force him to undergo any psychiatric assessments. Keep the terms of that agreement in mind, because it will be important later. Tony got what he wanted. By the time he left his sister's home, the money had been transferred to his bank account, and the woman had agreed not to take any further action against her brother. And, likely in absolute terror of what he might do, she stuck to that. In fact, if it hadn't been for what Tony ended up doing 10 years later, no one outside the Karitsis family may ever have known about this. Interestingly, this event had become such a secret that later, when one of Tony's brothers, who was still close with him, was interviewed on the news and asked about it, he denied it ever happened. But it was later confirmed to have occurred by Tony's own defence attorney and Essie's eventual testimony in court. There was another claim that Tony had taken a city official hostage as well at some point, but that claim was never verified. It was clear, though, that Tony had often gotten into violent arguments when he was in a rage, And much of the trouble he got into seemed to revolve around him feeling like people were out to get him in one way or another. Tony seemed quite paranoid and often blamed the challenges he was experiencing on other people, whether that blame made sense to anyone else or not. Having got away with holding his sister hostage, and even having financially benefited from it, Tony continued on with his life. And in 1973, he embarked on a business venture that would change many people's lives, and not necessarily in a good way. With Tony's dad having owned a trailer park, he'd always figured himself a bit of a property mogul in the making, and he'd had a few false starts with Dad over the years. That was until he identified a plot of 17 acres of land in Indiana that he believed would be ideal for a strip mall. To fund the purchase, Tony took out a $100,000 loan from a company called Meridian Mortgage, which was run by a father and son duo, M.L. Hall, and his son Richard, who was known as Dick. For 3 years, things went well, and Tony was paying off his loan regularly, and he claimed he'd started to negotiate with builders and tenants with a view to having ground broken within the next year. But then, things started to go downhill. Exactly how things went badly is a matter of who you listen to, Tony Caritzis or the Halls from Meridian Mortgage. The Halls' version, and this would be borne out by much of the evidence, is that Tony started being late on his loan payments in 1976. His payments were erratic, and he would often skip months and then try to catch up. The Halls said they gave him as much grace as they could, but by the time he was 4 months behind in payments, as a business, they had to call it, and they told Tony that they were going to begin foreclosure proceedings on the property to recoup their money. Tony was understandably very unhappy, but unlike the vast majority of people who would have understood that this was sort of what happens if you don't pay your bills, and while it's incredibly sad, it is how these matters work. Tony decided that this was a personal attack. More than that, Tony believed that the Halls had set out to purposefully destroy his chances of developing the land by warning off investors and possible tenants and telling lies about him. He claimed that the land he owned was so valuable that Meridian Mortgage wanted him to default on his payments so that they could take it for themselves. The Halls had set the final date for foreclosure proceedings to begin on the 1st of March 1977. Tony had until that day to settle his outstanding debt, or he would lose his land. The battle between Meridian and Tony raged on until the 8th of February 1977, when he left his Crestwood Village apartment with a sawed-off shotgun in a suit box, a roll of steel wire, and a pistol shoved in the waistband of his pants. Tony made his way over to the offices of Meridian Mortgage in the center of Indianapolis. He entered the reception and told the receptionist he was there to see Hall Sr. The woman said that he was on holiday in Florida and wouldn't be back for 2 weeks. This moment is one of many that would follow, which showed me at least that while Tony had put a lot of thought into how he was going to carry out the crime, he also took a lot for granted and didn't seem to put much forethought into a plan B. He seemed to assume everything would just go his way, which is interesting from a psychological perspective. After hearing that Hall Sr. wasn't there, Tony asked for his son, Richard, or Dick, as he is referred to in most sources. The receptionist confirmed that he was there and was about to put a call through to his office to announce Tony's presence when Tony walked into the building and entered Dick's office without knocking. Tony had been at the Meridian Mortgage headquarters several times before, so he knew his way around. As he entered and Dick Hall looked up, Tony pulled the pistol from his pants and instructed Dick not to move. Holding the man at gunpoint, he then proceeded to open the suit box he had with him and started assembling his shotgun. He then put together the device that would become synonymous with this case and, of course, give the movie its name, The Dead Man's Wire. Tony wound a piece of steel wire around Dick's neck and then attached the wire to the barrel of the gun and the trigger. The barrel was pointed directly at the back of Dick's head, and if anyone tried to tackle Tony or Dick tried to escape, he would be shot in the head. It could also be set off accidentally, though, if Dick or Tony tripped and fell, but Tony seemed more than happy to take that chance. With his mechanism set up, Tony used Dick's office phone to call 911, and the call you heard a part of in the beginning of this episode ensued. The 911 call lasted 50 minutes. Tony explained to the officer that he'd been treated unfairly by Dick Hall and his father, and he was going to be holding Hall hostage until his demands were met. His list of demands were as follows. $5 million in payment from the Halls for what he considered as damages and future loss of earnings, a letter from them confirming that they had treated him unfairly, and he wanted immunity from prosecution for the acts of holding Hall hostage. Sound familiar? Those are almost identical terms to those he demanded and got when he held his sister hostage a decade before. The 911 operator did very well to keep the situation calm, although I had to wonder if at some point, even if just early on, he must have thought Tony was pulling a prank. I'm guessing that once the operator alerted police about the situation, they were then able to do some follow-ups, like contacting reception and confirming that Tony was indeed in the building. While on the 911 call, Tony demanded that he get a police escort to ensure that no one tried to intervene. He said he'd be taking Hall back to his own apartment in his vehicle. Tony stayed on the line with the operator until he could confirm that officers were downstairs, waiting to escort Tony and Hall. Then the pair, bound by the shotgun and wire, began a slow descent down four flights of stairs before walking out onto the street. Out on the freezing cold streets, the two men were met with a group of armed officers. As soon as the cops saw the device attaching the shotgun to Hall, they realized that they were in a pretty difficult predicament. You'll see reenactments of this scene in the movie, and some of you may think it couldn't be possible that this really happened. But let me tell you, it absolutely did. And I've seen the actual original photographs and footage, and it's some of the most bizarre stuff I've ever seen. Tony starts walking down the street with the gun aimed at the back of Hall's head, and there are about 10 police officers surrounding him, all armed, but they're literally helpless. There is nothing they can do but walk next to him. As the strange group moved through the streets of Indianapolis, members of the public looked on in horror as what they were seeing sunk in. Police did their best to clear the sidewalks of pedestrians, but could do nothing about passing cars. One man driving by became so distracted by the scene that he crashed into a telephone pole. After traversing several blocks with Tony refusing to indicate where they were going, it became clear that he was lost. It would later emerge that he'd parked his own car in a parking garage near to Meridian Mortgage, but when he'd exited the building, he'd gone the wrong way with Hall in tow and ended up steering the entourage down several streets unnecessarily. By this time, the media had been alerted to the odd situation and had descended on the offices of Meridian Mortgage. There, they were informed that Tony, Hall and a group of officers had gone down the street. A few stayed behind at the office, but others walked down the street to find the scene they sought. Tony, meanwhile, was becoming frustrated at his wrong turn and started taking his anger out on police. As they tried to negotiate with him to let Hall go, he launched a tirade and suddenly swung Hall and the shotgun around to face the officers. As he did, Tony lost his footing on the slippery, snow-covered walkway and stumbled down to one knee. Almost instinctively, as Hall felt the pull of the dead man's wire on his neck, he crouched down to where Tony was. There was a collective holding of breath as both slowly righted themselves, and everyone seemed a little surprised that the gun hadn't gone off. After this incident, Tony became clearly agitated, perhaps concerned that police would think the gun or the device were not real, and he began to tell the officers they needed to arrange a car for him. By chance, a few blocks down, the group passed a police car which had been parked in the middle of the road to block traffic. The door was open and the engine still running, with the police officer it belonged to standing a few meters away to wave cars back. Tony immediately decided that they were taking the police car and started guiding Hall in that direction. The officers did their best to try to convince him not to get in the car, as they realized they would lose control of the situation if they lost sight of him. But Tony ignored them. He pushed Hall up to the officer standing near the car, told the man to hand over his handcuffs, and then carefully navigated getting Hall into the driver's seat of the vehicle with Tony behind him, holding the shotgun. At a snail's pace, with Hall undoubtedly terrified to move, even to steer the vehicle, the pair made their way in the vehicle to Tony's apartment. A cavalcade of police cars followed behind. When they arrived at the complex Tony lived in, he and Hall made their way up to Tony's apartment. I can only imagine how terrified Dick Hall must have been at this point. Up until now, he'd at least been surrounded by police and other people, with the small comfort that must have brought. Now, though, he was completely alone with this very angry man, and what he heard next sent shivers down his spine. Police quickly set up a perimeter outside the apartment complex and established a line of communication with Tony. And on the first phone call, Tony told the negotiator that he had booby-trapped his apartment with bombs so they couldn't try to force entry. Upon hearing this, the entire apartment complex was evacuated. And if Tony's fellow tenants hoped for a quick resolution, as they quickly packed the essentials and gathered up their pets, they would certainly not be granted that. During this time in the United States, television media was entering a new era. While previously it would only be radio stations who could bring live report from the scene of an event, the technology had recently become available to do the same for television. And this would become a very important part of this case. The media contingents had joined the mass of police officers outside, seeing the opportunity to use this new technology available to them to report on a case that would undoubtedly be changing quickly. They could have absolutely no idea how true that would be. Once Tony was settled in his apartment and perhaps feeling more emboldened, he decided to up the ante a little. Instead of just a written apology, he told police he wanted the apology to be broadcast live, and he wanted to have direct contact with a specific journalist at WIBC Radio News so he could investigate and verify his claims about Meridian Mortgage. The reporter Tony named, Fred Heckman, was well known in Indianapolis, and his voice had become synonymous with asking tough questions and getting important answers. It would emerge that Tony seemed to deeply respect Heckman's work, and while that would be very helpful in negotiations, the whole situation also put Heckman and his employer in an unprecedented dilemma. It seemed clear that Tony wanted to use Heckman as a mouthpiece, which understandably presented some problems for something that should be an unbiased profession. The situation, though, was something most in Heckman's position had never faced before. A man's life was at stake, and allowing Tony to have this few minutes of expression may be a matter of life or death. One of the main things they were concerned about, really, was Tony's often prolific use of foul language. There was no way they could censor the words out if he was live on air, so they would just have to warn people of the possibility and take the risk. Day one of the hostage drama came to an end without any resolution, and as darkness blanketed the apartment complex, police continued to keep vigil outside. Throughout the night, Tony was quiet and didn't communicate with anyone. At 6:30 a.m. the next morning, Fred Heckman reached out to Tony on his telephone, and the man answered. The pair chatted for a while before Heckman decided to comply with Tony's request and put him live on air. Tony rambled on about his grievances with Meridian Mortgage and what he wanted out of the situation. This first engagement with Heckman cemented something in Tony's mind, and he began to reach out to Heckman even when he wasn't on air. During the time he held Hall hostage, he ended up speaking more with Heckman than the official negotiator. Many of these conversations were either live on air or recorded by Heckman and played back by Tony's request. Some conversations were just friendly chats, though, and had nothing to do with the situation at all. Tony seemed to be deeply enjoying connecting privately with the famed newsman, and while that might speak to him feeling isolated, I also wonder how much of that was him feeling important by having this direct line to a pretty famous person in the area. A limited period subscription to that level of power, perhaps. The second day of the hostage drama brought with it even more press attention. Crowded outside were not just Indiana-based reporters, but also those whose reach was nationwide, and some even international. There was live television as well as radio coverage happening from the scene, and this element added something new to these types of crimes that would change the way law enforcement across the country saw live news coverage. Tony was quite enjoying the attention his crime was getting, and he had his television and his radio playing non-stop in his apartment. As a result, when journalists updated the public about what they were seeing happening, he was getting those updates too. When one reporter mentioned that they'd seen the police's bomb squad setting up in what looked like an operation to breach Tony's apartment, Tony heard this and became completely irate. He screamed out the window that if anyone came anywhere near his apartment, he would blow Dick Hall's head off. It took several calls from Heckman to calm him down. With live TV reporting being so new, this was the first time police understood how dangerous it could be, and eventually it would be standard practice to stop journalists from getting so close to the scene that they might relay police tactical information inadvertently through their reporting. 20 years later, when the now infamous Columbine school shooting happened, this problem resurfaced when reporters outside the school were broadcasting live, including using helicopter shots, which showed exactly where police were positioned. Inside the school, pupils were watching on televisions in classrooms as they hid from their attackers. The two killers had already taken their own lives by that point, but no one else knew that, and it could have been a serious problem if they too had been watching. In the fallout from that crime, the risk of live reporting once again had to be reviewed, as new technology had been added. Police brought in behavioural experts from the FBI in an attempt to understand exactly what was driving Tony and what might get him to stand down. They also flew in Tony's brother, Jimmy, in the hopes that he would be able to talk some sense into his brother. Tony had not wavered on his demands. He still wanted Meridian Mortgage to admit their liability in his financial downfall. He wanted his $5 million, and he wanted immunity from prosecution. The state prosecutor had been called in to provide his input into what Tony was asking for. There was no doubt that if he was given immunity, it would just open the door for every other criminal who wished to do the same and get away with it. By the end of the second day, police and the media were wondering how much longer this could continue for. At some point, Tony would run out of food, and it appeared he was becoming more and more unhinged. As the third day of Tony's siege dawned, a sense of optimism seemed to pervade the police officers on scene. Journalists were unsure as to whether this was just a ruse to boost public morale, but behind the scenes, things were happening. Tony had been promised that he would not be prosecuted for his crimes, and Meridian Mortgage were drafting an apology and had apparently agreed to give him $5 million. It seemed that Tony was about to get everything he wanted. And as the hours ticked by, he had several calls with Heckman and his brother about how he planned to spend his new wealth and what he would do with his freedom. Part of the agreement was that when Tony was satisfied that his demands had been met, he would detach the device from around Dick Hall's neck and let him go. Then, once Hall was safely with police, Tony would exit with his hands up so they knew he was not armed and allow police officers to frisk him to make sure he had no weapons on him. As day turned to night on the third day, journalists began to notice a buzz moving through the police contingent. Tony had finally agreed to release Hall. But what happened next was not what he had originally agreed to. As both Tony and Hall were spotted descending the stairs of the apartment complex, journalists and police officers realized that Hall still had the dead man's wire around his neck and the shotgun to the back of his head. Tony had not followed through with the agreement. It soon became clear that Tony was going to eke out every ounce of public attention he could get, and he wanted to hold an impromptu press conference during which he would air out all of his problems and Hall would read Meridian Mortgage's apology letter. Police took a few minutes to discuss the proposal privately. It would later be revealed that they were seriously concerned that Tony was about to kill Hall on live television and then take his own life. A quick plan was put together, which included an officer standing by as close to Tony as he could get, with a small firearm, which could be placed behind Tony's ear and fired quickly if there was an indication that he was about to kill Hall. The placement of the gun would mean that the bullet would have a better chance of immediately killing him, with there being no time for him to pull his own trigger. The police team's senior in charge came up with an easy signal if he decided the time had come to take Tony down. He placed a red handkerchief in the inside pockets of his jacket, and the agreement was that if he took that handkerchief out and dabbed at his brow, that was the signal for the officer to shoot and kill Tony. If you watched the footage of this impromptu press conference, you can actually see the senior in charge start to reach into his jacket on several occasions and then slowly pull his hand back out without the handkerchief in it. All the while, Tony has no idea how close he is coming to death. Eventually, several police officers, all the major news channels, Fred Heckman, Jimmy, Tony's brother, and Tony and Dick Hall, all gathered in the reception of the apartment building. Tony was in his element, looking around the room, spotting police officers he knew and calling out to them, yanking Hall around by the neck when he felt like it, demanding drinks of water, and even for someone to pull up his pants at one point. At first, he'd wanted Hall to read Meridian's apology, but the man's throat was painful from the wire pressing around it for so long, and he was understandably anxious, so he was stumbling over the words so much that Tony eventually ripped the paper from his hands and began to read it himself. He seemed pretty dissatisfied with the apology letter and kept stopping reading and adding in his own commentary. He apologized to viewers for his foul language, which had peppered the entire diatribe, and also apologized to Dick Hall for forcing him to take his father's punishment. Finally, Tony bragged to the cameras that he was going to be walking free after he finished up there. He ended by thanking Fred Hickman for his help, and then, unceremoniously, said he was finished. Immediately, police shuffled him and Hall off into an adjoining room, and reporters were made to leave the building. They were confused, not knowing what was happening, as they huddled outside in the cold. Back inside, Tony agreed to let police cut the dead man's wire off Hall's neck. The man's neck had started to swell from days of pressure around it, so it took some time to get it off. But finally, he was free, and quickly escorted from the building to a waiting ambulance and throngs of journalists trying to get his side of the story. Just as he was being loaded into the ambulance, a gunshot blast was heard from inside the building. Journalists rushed back to try and see what was happening, with many wondering if Tony had shot himself. What had actually happened is that Tony had decided he wanted one last hurrah, and he'd shot out the window to prove that the gun had been loaded all along. As he did this, he was tackled by several police officers and wrestled to the ground. Although there's no actual footage of this moment, the scene you'll see depicted in the movie was likely very accurate, as Tony was being led out of the building in handcuffs, he was clearly incredibly confused as to why he was being arrested. The truth, as Tony would quickly come to learn, was that the negotiations had pretty much been a sham, at least from the police's end, and certainly from Meridian Mortgage's end. They would later make it clear that although they had apologized to get Dick Hall out of that situation, they did not take any responsibility for anything in the letter. They also were not planning on giving Tony $5 million, and if he wanted it, he could sue them for it, which he would only be able to do after his trial for the several criminal counts he was now charged with. The police and prosecutor had also never planned on following through with the proposed deal. In the end, they said, Tony himself had broken the terms of the deal by not releasing Hall in the way they'd agreed, and insisting on the impromptu press conference, which had put them in a very difficult position. In truth, in an interview with the prosecutor, he said, in not so many words, that he had never planned to give Tony immunity, and he believed any judge would throw out such an agreement, based on the fact that they'd had no choice, as Hall's life was at risk. They would later argue that what Tony had done was essentially extortion, and therefore anything offered within the midst of that extortion was null and void after the event. As journalists did their final reports from the scene with a police car containing Tony driving away in the distance, most felt that this would not be the last time they'd hear from the man. Tony was still seemingly in shock at the unexpected turn of circumstances, at least unexpected for him perhaps, when his trial began a few months later. He was charged with kidnapping, armed robbery, and armed extortion, and he would go through two sets of lawyers before he was finally ready for trial. The lawyer who ended up representing Tony, Niall Stanton, said that his counsel troubles really came down to Tony not liking being told what to do. He continued to insist that he knew better than his attorneys, and most of them simply could not work with him. Stanton tried a different tack, almost like Fred Heckman's approach. Niall appealed to Tony's sense of self and tried to frame his advice as Tony using the tools available to him to beat a system which had done him wrong. Niall's advice, which Tony eventually ended up grudgingly agreeing to, was to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. If you remember anything about Tony's ongoing desperation not to be seen as crazy, going way back to when he took his sister hostage, you'll probably get a sense of how much convincing this would take. As if Tony's crime hadn't already set enough precedents in law and television, and the convergence thereof, when his trial started, he would set yet another, when it became one of the first trials broadcast on national television in the United States. Also at the time of Tony going to trial, when an accused intended to use insanity as a defense, the law still put the burden of proof on the state to prove the individual was sane. After Tony's case, this law, which had applied for 160 years in Indiana, would be changed to require the defense to prove insanity. Other states across the U.S. would also take this case as a warning to address their own insanity defense laws. But as the trial began, the prosecution in Tony's case had the pretty difficult job of proving that Tony Caritsis, the man the whole country had watched march around with a gun wired to someone's head and make long rambling diatribes about all the persecution he faced, was sane beyond a reasonable doubt. It was always going to be a pretty tough win. Part of the prosecution's plan was to prove that the Halls had never been anything but fair with Tony. They'd followed the written loan agreement between them to the letter, and they'd even given him far more grace in terms of payments than they needed to. Unfortunately, because of the burden of proof, although they did prove this, it actually backfired on them and ended up helping the defense, because essentially what the jury was hearing was that the very thing that Tony's whole argument was based on, his poor treatment by the Halls, did not exist. And therefore, how could he be sane if he would go so far based on what was essentially a false story? Despite Tony's significant aversion to psychiatrists, it would be a psychiatrist who would give some of the most helpful evidence to his case. Dr. Ivor Small, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the IU Medical School. The doctor testified that, in his opinion, Tony was indeed suffering from a mental disease or defect at the time of his actions, and that this made it such that he could not conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. Insanity, in this context, is obviously a legal term and not a psychiatric term. No psychiatrist would take the stand and say Tony was insane at the time. Dr. Small said that Tony was in a paranoid delusional state, or a psychosis. Now, I must say that from other cases I've looked at, there definitely could have been pushback against this finding. Psychotic states are usually time-bound and do not allow for the individual to carry out such focused and detail-oriented tasks. While there may have been an element of delusion, today that would certainly be viewed, in my opinion, more as a matter of personality disorder and not a mental health illness, which would meet the level of disordered mental states that meant Tony was not responsible for his actions. But this was the 1970s, and perhaps understandably, things were seen a little differently. Surprisingly, Tony Caritsis took the stand in his own defense. And again, his presence there only helped to solidify the idea that things in his brain were certainly not operating on the same level as many other people. Despite a lot of evidence having already been presented to show that the Halls had not, in fact, done him in, Tony persisted with that belief on the stand. He also displayed a lot of remorse around his actions, though, and he said he couldn't quite believe he'd done what he had. The defense was also able to call a few of Tony's police officer friends, who perhaps not wanting to admit that they'd missed the underlying criminality in a man they thought they'd known so well, described Tony as a good, law-abiding man who must have been in an altered state of mind to do what he had. As if there wasn't already enough drama in this case, during a lunch break one day at a local coffee shop, one of the jurors started choking, and Tony's brother, Jimmy, ended up saving the man's life by applying the Heimlich manoeuvre. The juror recovered fully, and everyone couldn't help but wonder if he would have been sitting there in the jury box, deliberating, going, "Well, this guy's brother did save my life." The prosecution had discovered Tony's prior hostage-taking of his sister and decided to call her as a witness to testify about Tony's violent past. She'd made a compelling witness, as by that time she was wheelchair-bound by severe arthritis and clearly very frail. The prosecution hoped that her fragility would have the jury wondering whether Tony was just a really bad man after all. What they seemed to take from this, though, at the end of the day, was that Tony had pretty much been out of his mind for most of his life. By the time the jury went over into deliberations, there wasn't really a clear view of how things might go. It seemed that the prosecution, and reportedly even the judge, believed that Tony would be found guilty. But when the verdict came in, relatively quickly, many were incredibly surprised to hear that the jury had in fact found him not guilty by reason of insanity. The courtroom erupted. Tony hugged his legal team and seemed incredibly relieved, while Dick Hall and the prosecution shook their heads in disappointment. This moment has echoes of when Tony released Dick Hall, expecting to be free himself, and then realizing that was not the case. Because if Tony thought he was going to walk out of the courtroom a free man, he was sorely mistaken. 2 weeks later, due to his very own plea that he was insane, the court decided that the best course of action would be to commit Tony to a psychiatric facility until doctors there confirmed he was no longer a risk to society. He was kept in custody and taken straight to the facility in question. Tony's aversion to psychiatrists and any assessment of his mental health really stood against him in the months and years to come. He refused to comply with assessments or treatment while in the facility. On several occasions, he tried to take the state to court to force them to release him, but he failed each time. At one point, he was actually charged with contempt for refusing to comply with mental health assessments and spent time in the medical section of the local prison before being transferred back to the psychiatric facility. This went on for 10 years. During that time, he transferred his plot of land to his brother's name, and the land was eventually repossessed. Also during that time, Meridian Mortgage suffered significant financial losses on other projects and was liquidated. Finally, in 1987, Tony agreed to see a psychiatrist from outside of the state system for an assessment. The psychiatrist found that he was safe to release, and the state psychiatrists reviewed that report and agreed, probably only happy to see the back of this particular patient. Tony was released in January 1988. 2 years later, he was once again back in the public eye when he filed 101 lawsuits in the Superior Court against a huge number of parties involved in the original incident. There's no information in the public record that I could find about the outcome of these lawsuits, but I would think that almost 20 years later, many would have been beyond the statutes of limitations. I guess at least he was taking his fight for justice through the correct channels this time. Except it goes to show that his delusions of persecution had still not fully been resolved. In January 2005, Tony Caritsis died in his home from natural causes. He may not have become the property mogul he hoped to be, but what he had done had certainly had an impact on the state and the country he lived in, and it would be a story told for many more years to come. Case in point, now in 2026, you've watched or are about to watch the story of what he did. In 2017, Dick Hall published a book called Caritsis and Me. With the story back in the public's mind, podcast and documentary series followed, culminating in Dead Man's Wire, now on your big screens. Dick Hall passed away in 2022 after a brief illness. And that is the real story behind Dead Man's Wire. And if you've watched the movie or are booked to see it, you'll see that it's pretty darn close. I do highly recommend sticking around after the credits roll at the end of the movie, because the makers include some actual footage and photos of the real crime afterwards, which is pretty cool to see. I spent quite a lot of time trying to figure out why the story is still so relevant after all these years. So much so that an incredibly popular movie would be made about it. The obvious stuff, of course, is that it's just a wild story in anyone's book. But I think there is a theme here that is something we deal with every day. And that is the system's treatments of the so-called little guy. And big corporates often taking advantage of people who are just trying to make a life for themselves and their loved ones. And even though the Halls and Meridian Mortgage were still legally within their bounds and did actually give Tony more leeway than they had to, the premise of what Tony was angry about was something many could still resonate with back then, and still do today. Although the vast majority of people did not agree with the way Tony handled his problems, especially because they were able to witness the violence and Hall's suffering firsthand, many people understood the base of his feelings and the inequality of it all, which so many had suffered themselves in some form at some point in their lives. And this is the reason that Avenger-type criminals are often quite popular in the public domain. A pretty drastic recent example would be Luigi Mangione, who is accused of murdering United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. From day one of that murder case, there's been a huge amount of online support for Mangione, from Americans especially, who've had serious challenges with healthcare in their country. I guess it boils down to this. Murder, or any violent crime, is never justifiable. Defendable in a court of law, certainly, but regardless of who we are talking about as the victim, there is always someone who loves them. And they have the right to life, just like the rest of us breathing human beings. In fairness, I can understand the anger. A lot of people in positions like this do a lot of harm to ordinary people, who definitely don't deserve it. And then there's the aspect of them making huge amounts of money off the average Joe or the average Tony. The irony is that the Hall family didn't really hold on to the wealth they made in the mortgage business. Quite by contrast, by 2017, Hall publishing that book was, according to several reports, a last-ditch attempt to make some money to get by. For the man who had once almost lost his life, because his privilege had almost literally driven someone mad. And really, if you think about it, if Tony's original grievance was anywhere near accurate, as he claimed, they used him to make money the first time. And then, long after he was dead and could do nothing about it, they sort of, in a way, used him again. If you've not yet seen Dead Man's Wire, I strongly recommend you book your tickets now and get out there and see it. Dead Man's Wire opened in cinemas nationwide on 23 January. It's not just a retelling of an infamous and shocking case. It's also a conversation starter about who deserves what in this world and what justice really looks like. A huge thank you to Dead Man's Wire and Empire Entertainment for supporting the production of this companion podcast to the brand new release movie, Dead Man's Wire.